Welcome to The Code Review, a weekly web development podcast with your hosts Dylan Marsh and Brandon Timmish.
Hello, everybody. I'm Dylan Marsh.
And I'm Brandon Timmish, and this is The Code Review.
This week, we are talking about scaling your company, annual company compliance, and keeping costs low. So kind of a trend of if you run your own business as a contractor. So
yeah.
We've been asked in the past to talk about this a little bit, and we were asked again to kind of dive in deeper. So this is our attempt to do that.
Yeah. I guess starting out, in the past, we've talked a lot about, capacity and how much work you can do on your own. And it really, as you start getting more and more people, more clients asking for your services, at some point you're going to hit that capacity threshold and you just can't take any more work. So that's kind of our first topic, diving into when you should start scaling and hiring help and how you should go about doing that.
That's like one of the hardest things to decide for yourself, right? It's a really awkward transition because you're going from like, I have these maybe a client at a time and, things aren't super stable, but like, it seems like as soon as I'm done with a project, someone says something and then someone reaches out and now I have another project. But, you have to at some point decide, like, can I take, am I happy to take a smaller piece of that pie of the money from that client and then share it with somebody that I can work with?
Yeah.
And, it kind of gets to that interesting part. Like every time you bring somebody on board to a project or like you have your own style of writing apps and like you have existing relationships with clients and you need to bring that person up to speed. And that takes time. That takes time away from you coding. And especially in the beginning, if you're not used to doing it, the amount of time you're saving by having somebody help you write code, you may be losing to manage that person.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's even more where you're spending even more time. And it turns out that that relationship wasn't really worth it. So that's like a really tricky thing to get into is really hiring hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what I mean by hiring hard is like taking your time to find the right person that you know is going to be less of an onboarding challenge. And once they're onboarded, they'll likely stick around for a bit. And then you can not micromanage that person and get back to doing what you do best. And that's writing code and serving your clients. So
yeah,
it's a tricky thing to do.
Yeah. And I mean, another part of that too, is, as you continue to scale, if you hire more and more people, at what point are you doing more managing of people as opposed to writing code? Cause I mean, I feel like even there would have to be a capacity there as well, where you have like too many people. You're like, I can't write any, like, I just have to set up contracts with clients and like direct people to where they're supposed to go.
And that's, when you're writing code for clients, you're like a freelancer and you want to like have other subcontractors helping you. That's an easy thing to discount is like, at what point is your next hire a manager? Because if you're like, if you're the founder of your little code for hire shop, you're the leader, the CTO. Doesn't mean you necessarily have to be the project manager and the lead engineer and the lead designer and the CEO, like find your kind of your role. Mm-hmm. And for me, like I've done this in the past and like, I still own a company. And for me, it's to be that CTO role where like, out of the gates, you have to do it all because you're just small.
Yeah.
But people follow good leaders' actions. Like you lead by example, not by an iron fist or just telling people what to do.
Yeah.
That's especially if you're small and you have like other subcontractors working with you. If you never hire out or farm out that management responsibility or give your team ways to like self-manage or do peer review, and then you're coding less and less and less or not at all.
Yeah.
That's a hard person to rally behind because it's like, well, why don't you do it? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you get in here and help us. We have this big deadline. You're not writing code.
Like, yeah,
if you're the guy with the whip. You know what I mean? That's an awkward position to get into.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, too, with like self-management or, having employees that self-manage, and you were saying waiting and hiring the right person. I think that definitely comes down to if you hire someone, you should trust them enough to like do what they need to do. And so, like you said, you might need a manager, but definitely in the beginning, I feel like it seems like with startups, a lot of the initial employees really have to be like self-driven. Like it, yeah, there's not really any room for.
You're hiring extensions of you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially like if in our world, it's so client relation based, like everything that your team is doing and you're doing, a lot of it's like this client has this image of you and your company and your peers. So like, yeah, those first few people, they carry a ton of weight, and likely for your startup, you don't have a ton of money to compensate those people. So you have to hire very, very hard and intelligently and take your time and think about personality and think about what this person may value. And does those values align with our goals? Like we've talked about a ton of these topics. This is all kind of like going into like a really big step as a freelancer, which is scaling out. So,
yeah. So I guess, you know, we've talked about interview tips before, but as a freelancer or as an employee, but I guess to kind of flip the tables, what would you give as tips for somebody that might be new to scaling up a company and trying to hire people? Like what kinds of questions should they be asking?
Well, the very first thing, and I've been in the seat, I've had to interview people for a company before, and people are nervous when they go to interviews, no matter how good they are, how old they are, gender, race, like all people get nervous in an interview. People show their nervousness differently. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So first thing I do is really try to take that away. Like we're going to have an extremely informal conversation. I'm not going to grill you with like crazy code questions. Like seriously, Windows. Hopefully that had come through the recording. But yeah, it's just one of those things where like you don't want to stress somebody out because then they're not going to perform at their highest level. And you don't want to see what they're not going to be like in the job.
Yeah.
So once you get the job and you've like kind of like, you know, gotten in, you're not going to be like a nervous wreck like you are in an interview. It's your job as the interviewer to try to replicate a normal scenario for that person to be in.
Yeah.
And interviews just aren't. So if you want to really make sure you're getting like a top-notch engineer and you're preparing all of these like gotcha stumping questions and you like really want to drill this person and get them on the whiteboard, show us code, I think you're making a huge mistake because that's not reality. You're crafting an interview and not a conversation with a person because you're going to have to talk to this person a ton. You're going to have to solve problems with this person a ton.
Yeah.
Your job is to really get out of them a comfortable response to basic things like, why do you like this? Why are you passionate about it? Like, what are your goals? Just stay away from the like, tell me your 5-year plan and where do you see yourself? there's some great questions that I've used before, like, you know, if you're on an island or, you know, what 3 things would you bring with you? Or if you had 24 hours to do absolutely anything in the world, what would it be? And then using the island again, like if you're stripped of all of your roles and that's roles and relationships and titles and like everything that made you you and you're on this island all by yourself, I'm giving you 24 hours to think about your self-worth from 0 to 10. What would you rate yourself worth as? And that's sort of like you're looking for confidence, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if somebody can understand the difference between your roles and titles and responsibilities and like all these things, and it's like, well, at the core, how comfortable are you in your own skin? Especially in a startup, like that's important, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People have to have a little bit of tough skin, and you're looking for people that are super resilient and confident in their own abilities, and that maps pretty well. Like the people that are super, you know, either razzled or like really, really anxious in an interview will give very low scores. And people that are very self-assured give really high scores.
Yeah.
And I try to look for someone in like the 7-8 range. You know what I mean? Like not too extreme. But if somebody does score that low, then I know it's like a cue to me as the interviewer. I need to find a way to like remove tension from this conversation so that their personal score kind of comes up because that's the person that I want to talk to.
Yeah.
Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to go about it too. I don't think I've ever been asked that kind of question as a
like as an employee or anything like that.
So. Yeah, I gotta give credit. That one comes from Chad Brown, who was in an earlier podcast of ours.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, he does this for a living, and that's one.
It's a really creative question.
He taught to me. Yeah. But I like to ask those things more than the really crazy problem solving, like you got this rope. You've ever heard this one? I mean,
I've heard that. Yeah.
But that does the opposite. That creates more stress and tension and puts more pressure on the person. And it's like a time will come for that. And you could do multiple interviews. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you, if you do a phone screening and you keep it super casual, ask about experience, let them talk about themselves a little bit, then you bring them in, that person's already expecting to be grilled. And then when you don't, all their guard comes down.
Yeah.
Then the next time you talk to that person, you can get a little bit more technical, because then they're next time they come in, they're like, oh, well, this guy's like really easy to talk to. This is probably the easiest interview I've ever been in.
Yeah.
And then you say, hey, what do you think about this selector in CSS? And then when they mess it up, you just say, great, that was fantastic. You know, like I struggled with that for years. I had to look this up before I came in here because I didn't even know the answer. Like, say things to make them feel comfortable, even if it's a total lie.
Yeah. You know, I know it was something you said in the past too, was that you really like to look for people that are able to admit when they're wrong, or if they don't know the answer, they try to extrapolate from what they already know instead of just saying like, I don't know, and then just like stopping there.
Yeah, exactly. And don't let it like get awkward where you're just silent staring at them, like finish the problem, like jump into action and walk through it together.
Yeah.
Because then you're going to get to see like, okay, how coachable is this person?
Yeah.
You can really turn any of these like awkward moments into an interview, into like you, it's telling you something as the business owner or the interviewer or the department head, whatever you are, like you're shooting yourself in the foot if you're doing that, because you're not only are they stressed out and awkward, you're getting nothing out of the candidate.
Yeah.
And candidates are precious. There's not a whole ton of people knocking on the door to work for your startup. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. And I guess another thing too is like getting people excited to join your startup or your team. And I feel like the interview process is probably a big component of that. But, you know, what other ways, like, I mean, they see the job posting, like, how do you make a job posting even stick out?
Yeah, that's tricky. I don't know that I have a great answer for this. I mean, yeah. I've posted a few. It's just a matter of making it very clear what you're looking for, and not trying to like oversell your company and why it's so fantastic to work there, but just make it really easy. Because if somebody's looking for a job, they're going through lots and lots of postings. And at that point, they're likely not judging you on your culture and all this stuff. They're just seeing like, do my skills match up with these skills?
Yeah.
So like if you have a salary to offer, like make that front and center.
Mm-hmm.
If you have some benefits, just make it a bulleted list. Here's a bulleted list of requirements you need to have. And then something I like to do is like put in like, here's tools we use. Here's something. And then like a little footer of like, this is who the founders are and the company is, to touch on culture a little bit, but
yeah,
make sure it's really clear and known. Like this is lax, everything about us, it's lax. Cause that's our style, like a lifestyle company. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I guess the last thing too is just, you know, when you start hiring people on, how would you go about actually affording it?
Yeah, that's that can come in many different shapes and form. So the best way to do it, honestly, especially if you're just starting out, and these are some of your first hires as a freelancer, you likely don't have a ton of money in the bank. You're not like a funded company or anything like that, but it's just you have a client coming on, you know that if you can negotiate to some sort of like a fixed rate or a retainer or an hourly thing, you have to take a portion of that and dedicate it for a person, and then go find a person and use your lack of stability as a positive. So instead of saying like, well, you know, we don't really know how long this client's going to last and who knows, blah, 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 you just say like, hey, if you're working for another company and you're open to moonlighting, we want to talk to you because we can give you an extra $3,000 a month. And devs will like that. You know what I mean? Just find the right person for your thing. Like this is a temporary contract as needed position.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got a few hours in the evening or the weekends, you know, we'll fill that time for you.
Yeah.
And find five or six people like that. Maybe you got three of them just on standby, but you know you have capacity to scale up. So
Yeah.
That's the best way, is use other people's money to afford them, not your own. Yeah.
That seems to be a theme too. Like, yeah. Just get them to get clients to be able to foot the bill, or like if you have a contract, just pay a portion of that to the person that's doing the work and
get them to pay.
Yeah.
That's the point. Like, and it doesn't, there's no right or wrong on which percentage you take off the top. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's worth taking nothing off the top, because you know, like, you're buying the loyalty of a person, right? If you found someone that's like super good and they're like, well, I want to do this, but since it is like as needed, I want a little higher of a rate. Just say, great, like, I'll do that with this one. But the next one that comes around, would you mind giving me a few more hours at this lower rate? And, you know, try to negotiate with that.
Yeah.
Because buying people, especially the right person, it's better to do that than like give out equity in the beginning.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So I guess, kind of going forward with our second topic, you know, you're hiring help and everything, and then you start to get into that area where you've got company compliance and you've got to worry about these like business tasks that you never had to think about before.
Yeah. So. And it's not too crazy, but, you know, maybe a few times a year, probably quarterly, there's some like housekeeping little things that you have to do. And you should, as always,
assault an attorney.
Assault an attorney. Sometimes you want to, but consult with an attorney and an accountant and stuff, because we're just giving you our experience, not advice.
Yeah.
But getting a good local attorney to manage your minutes, to do annual compliance. Mine is really great at this. Like every year they'll just like send me a bill for like approximately $200-$300. And it's like, hey, here's a few forms, you fill them out. And some of the information on those forms gets a little financial. So like, it's nice to have an accountant, and especially if both are in town and know each other, the accountant fills out their part for the attorney. You just like check boxes, sign things, and then send it back. And if that attorney's worth what you're paying them, they'll kind of keep that compliance stuff going for you.
Yeah.
If you want to do it yourself, you certainly can. You can keep minutes if you're like an LLC. I mean, just like the type of business that you incorporate, not necessarily incorporate, but you form, has different, you know, rules and things you have to do to keep it going. But,
yeah.
You know, if you're just like staying up to date with the state and filing the forms that you're supposed to be filing, ideally someone's doing it on your behalf so that you know it's done properly. It's worth a few hundred bucks. You know what I mean? Because it's a paralegal doing it, not like a partner at a firm.
Yeah.
That's the like really the best way to go about it. So,
yeah.
And then, you know, you have taxes, and there's a lot of different ways to structure this as well. But with what we do is you have... you can have like a parent LLC, and an LLC, especially if you're doing this kind of stuff, is probably a pretty good thing to have. It's a limited liability company, which means there's a veil of protection between your clients and you personally, you as a human. you don't ever want to be sued over a project and then like they can take your home.
Yeah.
And that's like what an LLC does, is like your assets as a company that are liable is only the assets that belong to the company wholly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you do that, you can have like sub companies that you can make S corporations. And if the way you do like distributions and payroll, and if you bring this up to an accountant, they'll know exactly what you're talking about, that you want a parent company, then you want like a holding company that's elected as an S corporation, and you want funds to go from the parent to the child to you. You can save a ton on Social Security taxes. It's like the strategy behind that. And it's a pretty clean corporate structure. You have like a double veil of protection. You know what I mean? Like you're not actually named personally as a member on the parent company, but your holding company is.
Yeah. Would you be able to explain some of the stuff about the S Corp and kind of like what the benefits of that at, and, you know, having that holding company?
A little bit, to be honest. And the biggest benefit is really that you are saving a lot on Social Security taxes, because you're not just like a member of an LLC that's taking distributions. It's almost like you're paying yourself a salary. And then you definitely want to like, you know, have to, but I mean, if you're just yourself or you and a few people, you can drain your parent company of funds so that they're always paid out as salary.
Yeah.
And then you're paying payroll taxes quarterly as a company.
Mm-hmm.
to yourself. So it's like, I'm paying myself a salary of this fixed amount.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you try to deduct the remainder or stuff like that. So I am not an accountant or like a financial expert at all. Yeah. But that structure, doing it that way, is really clean. You're paying the set amount quarterly. Mm-hmm. Your accountant can help you set all that up. And you are certainly going to save a significant enough of a portion on these other little auxiliary taxes. And it's an extremely low risk scenario for your business. I mean, it's like less than 1 or 2% chance of an audit. It's extremely normal. Nothing is gray about it. It's just a good structure for that sort of stuff. And if you want to bring in a partner, like you bring that partner in as their holding company as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And then, yeah, it's just a pretty good way to do it.
Nice.
And then if you have any like side income or like personal things you're doing outside of your company, you have your own little S corp to deal with those things with,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And then, obviously I'm going to kind of just breeze through some of these tips we have jotted down. So this doesn't become like a financial podcast, but keeping track of deductions is a hugely important thing to do. Because at the end of the year, when you go to do like your federal taxes and file everything, federal and state, if you have an accountant, they're going to ask you, like, what did you spend money on? What were your big purchases? Did you buy any real estate? Like, how much is your cell phone bill? Like, all these things. And especially as a tech company, if you're a geek like us, a lot of your like personal purchases are probably like computers, phones. Your internet bill is probably ridiculous. You know what I mean? Like, you buy smart home stuff. Or if you work at home and you have like a home office, you can take, say, on my mortgage, I have, this is a hypothetical, but I have a 500 to 600 square foot area that is my home office.
Yeah.
You can actually take that square footage, deduct it from the total square footage of your home that your mortgage is calculated from, and deduct that amount as like personal space. You know what I mean? So, but keeping track of all that, I mean, there's like sweet apps. I shouldn't have to tell all you guys, you know, Google it. There's software as a service to take care of these things, like FreshBooks and QuickBooks, all that stuff. So
yeah,
it's pretty easy, but yeah, that's a big one. So I do want to talk about managing contractors. I like it. You have to have agreements and NDAs, and there are tax forms. So without like giving any specific advice, because I do think you need to do some research and talk to an attorney, we've given a lot of advice about what it's like to hire those contractors. You need to make sure that you, do it the right way. Like, there are forms and like ways to protect yourself. And then you do have to give them back tax forms, and they have to request their social security number and stuff so that you can actually give them those tax forms at the end of the year. So do it the right way. Don't just hire somebody and kind of do it all under the table.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. I guess, moving on past that company compliance and everything, another big thing that we've talked about was, you know, when we were talking about hiring people, how to afford it, but overall, like, keeping costs low when you're just starting out. And, you know, you mentioned that managing deductions, like all, like structuring your company correctly and managing those deductions and everything is going to help a lot. But I guess, do you have any other advice, for kind of keeping costs low and like keeping compliance? Like, I know one of the things too is that, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but you need to have a physical address for your business.
Yeah. So like with PCI compliance, you have to have like a contact form and like way for people to reach out for you and like an address listed, even like within emails and stuff. It's just good form anyway. You know, you could either go get a cheap office and work out of there, and that's all deductible. You know what I mean? And that's fine to have, but there's other options as well that aren't as apparent. Like, are there any incubators or business parks in your area? And even if they're not in your immediate area, most people in the U.S., just because how the U.S. is laid out, you live like at least within an hour of a major city. You know what I mean? It's pretty common. Look there. There's virtual offices too, through services like Regis, where you can have your mail forwarded on a regular basis. I think they do like daily, weekly, or monthly, or not at all. It's like an optional thing you can add on.
Yeah.
But yeah, just having that physical address that's not a PO box makes a pretty big difference. And in some cases, it depends on how you're implementing things for PCI compliance, you may need it. So that's a good one. But incubators, especially if you have like a college campus nearby, they probably have some sort of a program. In our area, we do have one, and it's like really cost effective to get like shared co-working space. WeWork is in a lot of cities now where you can get an actual mailbox and have a little space that you can share and go work at.
Yeah.
All of that is infinitely cheaper and less risky than like a lease on a space. And then you can use it as meeting space as well.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we always joke about bill it to the client, you know, any expenses that you can bill your client is a great way to keep costs low. And one thing that I just learned about recently is you can ask a lot of like software as a service providers for startup discounts, even if it's not like posted. I mean, if you're really like hungry and want to stay lean, you can actually reach out and be like, here's my idea. I'm a startup. Like, I have like no money. Your software is $50 a month. Like, can I pay you 30? Would you give me an account? Can I pay you 25? Or can I get a free 6-month trial until my client pays? And you'd be surprised, because I mean, a lot of these software as a service companies are pretty cool and lax, and they may say, actually go ahead. Because
software engineers have each other's backs.
Yeah. For them, it's like air. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like they're giving you a physical product.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, there's some cost to them hosting the service, but it's low. So
yeah.
Yeah, that's really all I have.
Yeah.
I'm talked out.
All talked out. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it just seems there's a lot of details. And like you said, your best bet is just talking to an attorney or an accountant and figuring all this stuff out for yourself. But
yeah, but hopefully we gave you something that's like, oh, that one thing resonated with me, so I'm going to dive deeper into it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of this you don't even like think about.
You know what I mean? And some of it too. I mean, like you said, like forming an LLC and then having like a subsidiary, like an S corp underneath it. I mean, you might not know what to ask your attorney when you get there. So hopefully we've given you guys some good tips for things to go forward with. I also know that this kind of just applies to the US. So for any of our listeners that are not within the US, I mean, I guess the advice still kind of applies, just, you know, going and asking and figuring it out. But some of the things that we said might not be as relevant to you, but hopefully it kind of points you in the right direction still.
Yeah. I think probably one of the coolest tips is to, in terms of like structuring your company, you have to talk to your attorney and your accountant because they have different interests for you, right? Sometimes you find an attorney that's really good with finances and structuring that and taxes as well. But typically you're like, I want to structure this in a way that gives me several veils of protection, and an attorney can help you with like, this is what you want to do. And here's different like insurance policies you may want to carry. And here's how you want to structure your bylaws for your company. And then an accountant may say, well, yeah, but then you also want to add the subsidiary and move your money this way for tax purposes. But if you're going to spend a few $100 to file with like LegalZoom or something like that, take that few $100, multiply it by 2 and get it done right. And then you've built a relationship with 2 people locally, an attorney and an accountant, because you're going to have to go back to those people.
Yeah.
Even if you use like a LegalZoom type service to incorporate, you still need someone to do your taxes. And unless you like paying more money, pay an attorney. They will save you.
So. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's all we have. Once again, as always, thanks for listening. You know, if you like, share, subscribe, share with others, and we'll hope to kind of dive in. I mean, we'll once again, you know, send us any questions you have, anything that we can touch on, like if maybe something stood out and you want some more details on it, feel free to send us a message and we'll try to cover it in more detail.
Yeah, definitely. And if you subscribe to the podcast right now, Brandon will literally drink water. All right, guys. Thank you. Talk to you next week.
Yeah, thanks, guys.